All right.
And during the few moments that we have left, we want to have just an off-the-cuff chat between you and me, us. We want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
Sophisticated killers now conspiring a plot. They skillfully assassinate you without firing a shot. Could be an activist, they hate a politician in office. The murders of them all are marked down as natural causes. Tampering with the forces of nature, they sick and remorseless. Silent executors,
poisoning the planet's resources. Generations of violations, irreparable damages. Technology misused for military advantages. Television programming that programs who watches it. Hypnotizing us all from intelligence to the opposite. It's mostly done for control and proceeds. Genes pumped into animals to double their growth speed. The invention of spy drones that see in your place. Plus cameras and satellites that can spot you from space. Facial recognition devices, RFID chips. Anything used for evil, Satan's world is equipped. Flawed technology, universal dichotomy. Flawed technology, universal dichotomy. Flawed technology, universal dichotomy. Malicious policy, part of the fulfillment of prophecy.
Greetings, greetings, greetings. Welcome to another episode. We're living on the edge. Welcome to another episode of Real Life. My name is Jenna Kepra, alongside of my partner, Brother Roz. How are you this evening?
Still learning as always, but I'm good. It's good to be on with you and everyone else this evening. Thanks for being with us this Tuesday, November 6th, 2018. Wow, the year's flown by. But yeah, I'm pretty all right. How are you?
Still learning, man. Tired. It's been a long day. And it's going to be a long day tomorrow. So hopefully to be done with this court and this slave catcher issue. Hopefully to be done with that. But that remains to be seen. Yeah. Today, let's get into today's show. Today is November the 6th, 2018. Thank you all for joining us, whether you're live or you will catch the podcast. Tonight's show is What Exactly Is Pro-Black? Now, this has been a reoccurring topic. And what I have found is that there's no consensus on what it actually is. Some people say this, some people say that. It's never really the same answer. I've come to the conclusion that people deem it to be whatever fits their particular need at that time. But before we dive right off into that, do like we always do, first things first. If you enjoy any of these programs that comes on, whether it's Real Life Radio or any of the other shows that come on the network, Black Talk Radio Network, by all means, you should give your financial energy. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com and hit the donate button. All donations are very much appreciated. You help Brother Scotty out to continue to have these type of programs put out so that we could have this particular type of dialogue without any interference. And if you're not already in BTR community, again, join us on BTR community, a social network that Brother Scotty put together for us to, that we won't be attacked. For the most part. And you can join that for $24 a year. And just go to btrcommunity.com and you can find us there. That's where all of our, most of the shows are posted. And also just to be able to have dialogue with like-minded people. Brother Roz, would you like to get into the medical articles before we jump into this conversation?
Sure. Let me get to that right now. Thank you very much. Let me see. I know there were a few I posted. I don't think there was a bunch, but there were a few. Let me just pull it up. Okay. The first one is from wakeupworld.com, and this one is six types of energy vampires that drain you emotionally. And we've talked about vampires of all types, especially energy vampires, when we did the show on the cows, when we did the book study club on the Delectable Negro, and how the culture created around the system of white supremacy is designed to actually partake of us, not just physically, as far as being physically consumed by white people. And there's quite a long history of that. But there's also ways in which they steal your energy just by having, it's like the attention economy before it was the attention economy. They have to be the center of everything, and they'll do anything to maintain that energetic flow from the victim to them. And sometimes it even comes in the form of abuse, whether it's verbal abuse, emotional abuse, what they would call gaslighting, narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy. These are all variant forms of behaviors that we've encountered dealing with white people, where they attempt to consume us in certain ways. And this kind of goes into six different types. So I'm just going to read the six different types so we can move on. The first one is the victim or martyr vampire. And these are energy vampires that prey off of your guilt. You have the narcissist vampire, which I just discussed, which is more or less a person who is so self-centered, they have to have all attention on them. The dominator vampire, which is a vampire that loves to feel superior, or alpha male, alpha female type of energy vampire. The fourth is melodramatic vampire, which are those who thrive on creating problems. And it says here that often their need to create constant drama is a product of dark underlying emptiness in their own lives. So true. I've met so many melodramatic vampires. It's ridiculous. The next one is the judgmental vampire. And this one just says, due to their severely low self-worth, the judgmental energy vampire loves to pick on other people. So that's and there's more to it. There's more for each one, but I just want to just read them so we can get through them quickly. And the last one is the innocent vampire. And energy vampires aren't always malicious, as in the case of innocent vampires. Sometimes they can be helpless types of people who genuinely need help. Help such as children or good friends who come to rely on you too much. So basically, that's the sixth type of energy vampire. And that one is a non-malicious one, as they were saying. So that I think is important, just because our mental health is so important. We just talked, I believe it was last week or the week before, about stress and how stress actually shrinks the size of the human brain. So I think that this is just another way that can be facilitated. The next one is from Humans Are Free. And it's entitled Pineapple Juice Found to Be 500% More Effective Than Cough Syrup. And that's something that I've used in the past, but there's actually a great recipe in there on how to get the best out of pineapple juice, so that when you're sick, actually you can go straight to the mixture that they provide there. They give you a great recipe, and ultimately it will be way more effective than any cough syrup you'll get from over the counter. I would also say if you can infuse it with some colloidal silver as well, that'll kill the germs in your throat and actually in your body that are getting you sick, to hopefully help you heal even faster. So that article is quite good and quite thorough. So I would say check it out. It's on in the Real Life, Real Life the Radio Show thread on BTR Community, The next one is from Global News, and it says Snapchat filters may seem harmless, but they're creating a new form of body dysmorphia. And what it is that people are now going through the process of getting some children getting plastic surgery so that they can look more like their Snapchat selfies. So it's creating this mental illness around wanting to look like whatever your doctored image is on Snapchat. And then I put another article dealing with the same issue from The Independent. Teenagers are getting plastic surgery to look like their Snapchat selfies, and it goes more into the mental health issues surrounding that. So again, these bits of technology, like the song said, seem to be beneficent, but they also come with a lot of caveats. And these are things that a lot of people's children are using very, very regularly. So you just want to really keep an eye on how much time your child or children might be spending on these social media platforms and apps for that reason. The next one is from Business Insider. A drug derived from marijuana has triggered the first federal shift on cannabis in half a century, and experts predict an avalanche effect. So they're talking about Epidiolex, and this is a CBD compound, which is a cannabidiol compound, which is a non-psychoactive part of the marijuana plant. and it's specifically created to help with seizures, specifically children who suffer from grand mal seizures, and there were a couple other ones that they named. And this is the first time, like they said, in 50 years, almost 50 years, that the there's a federal shift on the classification of cannabis to allow this drug to be actually manufactured by a pharmaceutical company. So this is the very first one. So yeah, so it's a very good article, very interesting, and it kind of gives predictions by experts in regards to the potential for marijuana laws to change quite quickly, a lot quicker than people expect. So this is a good article to get into as well. Was there another one? Oh yeah, there is. Let me see. You want me to go through the ones you have here too?
Yeah, you can go ahead on and knock those out, and we can jump right on into the show.
All right, cool. All right, so the next one is from Science Daily. A new family of promising silver-based anti-cancer drugs discovered. A family of economical silver-based complexes, simple to synthesize, show very promising results against a number of human cancers in laboratory tests with low toxicity in rat studies and minimal effects on healthy cells. So this is actually going into stuff we've talked about before, and we had other articles that were based on scientific evidence that shows that colloidal silver enhances the anti-cancer capability of anti-cancer drugs that may not work well on specific illnesses. And then they did an independent test with just the silver on its own and found that the silver alone killed the cancer cells more effectively than the anti-cancer drugs itself. And then we've also discussed silver-based chemotherapy, which is what I believe a couple of these articles go into that you have posted, which is a lot, which basically is safe for the human body, whereas with platinum-based, which is the normal route that hospitals will take, that is used to basically bring the body as close to death as possible, hoping to kill off the cancer cells and that the person or the organism will bounce back as far as the healthy cells, but the chemo is killing healthy cells and the bad cells. With the silver version, it only focuses on the negative cells and has no effect, little to no effect, on your normal healthy cells in the human body. So basically, silver is a targeted method of attacking cancer cells, is what they're discussing here. So the next one also is from The Independent, and this was scientists may have found a cancer vaccine. And I'll just read the blurb for now, but it says human trials have begun with a new cancer therapy that can prime the immune system to eradicate tumors around the body. The treatment that works similarly to a vaccine is a combination of two existing drugs of which tiny amounts are injected into the solid bulk of a tumor. So this is a new drug that they actually directly inject into the tumor that they've found helps to eradicate tumors. So this is another good article to get into, especially if you have any relatives that might be dealing with something like this. The next one is from The New Scientist, and this one is silver packs a punch as a chemotherapy drug. And it just says compounds of silver are as effective against breast and colon cancer cells as a leading chemotherapy drug and may result in fewer side effects. So we've also dealt with ovarian cancer and a bunch of other ones that including leukemia or blood cancer that silver is known to actually fight effectively. The next one is from The Silver Edge, and this one is colloidal silver, clinically proven destroyer of multi-drug resistant bacteria. So this is dealing with the type of bacteria you might encounter in a hospital, because hospitals are known to carry extremely dangerous drugs because they use ultraviolet light and other chemicals to clean the hospital. So those chemicals tend to kill the not too dangerous bacteria, but leaves the extremely dangerous bacteria behind. So a lot of people go to the hospital and end up sometimes getting fatal illnesses that they encounter while going to the hospital, either with someone else or for themselves. So this is article is dealing with the different types of multi-drug resistant bacteria that silver itself can kill. The next one is colloidal silver. This is also from The Silver Edge. Colloidal silver for the healthiest pets ever. And it just goes into the extremely myriad uses you can use colloidal silver to keep your pets healthy. And I think it's one that should be read for those who do have pets, whether it's dogs. I have turtles, but it works for all living things, like Dave has talked about quite often on Tando Radio Show. Next one is also from The Silver Edge, colloidal silver for fever blisters and other topical viral skin outbreaks. So it's talking about the effectiveness of different skin outbreaks and virus and viruses that colloidal silver actually is a cure for. I know that one is shingles. I was talking to Brother Jambone about that recently, that silver actually cures shingles. And there's also essential oil mixtures you can put together that also work for shingles. I wish I actually knew about colloidal silver when my father-in-law was alive and was dealing with that, because that was something that drove him quite insane. So that is something else that you want to look into that's in the thread as well. Let me see. Colloidal silver and rheumatoid arthritis. This is also from the Silver Edge. Colloidal silver and rheumatoid arthritis, a handful of anecdotal accounts, and now several clinical studies indicate that antimicrobial colloidal silver might help victims of rheumatoid arthritis. As you'll see below, researchers and commentators believe that silver is simply killing the underlying stealth pathogens or hidden pathogen infections of the joints. So this is something that that they're finding, is that the underlying issue with rheumatoid arthritis has nothing to do with aging. There's actually joint infections that facilitate the rheumatoid arthritis that causes the joint and bone deterioration. So, and this was something that was discussed by a doctor decades ago, and scientists kind of laughed at him about it. And then decades later, they found that he was absolutely correct. Now, what they do find is that colloidal silver actually works to kill the lung infection, and colloidal silver is also an anti-inflammatory. And there's actually stories of a woman who was severely debilitated by rheumatoid arthritis. And she talks about just using 10 parts per million colloidal silver regularly has transformed her life, and she no longer deals with the issues that she had, and it also helped her with severe asthma issues and a couple other things she talks about in the article. But I just think that that's something for folks to know. And also, if you do suffer from it or have someone that does, you should probably use anti-inflammatory essential oil. And there's something called D. The letters are D as in David, M as in Mary, S as in Sam, O as in Oscar. And it's basically a solution with which you can, with essential oils, you can add colloidal silver to it. And what it does is it actually, whatever you mix it with, is able to piggyback on it. And it has an extremely easy time passing through the cell membrane barrier to allow whatever part of the body you put that mixture on, it'll go directly to those cells. So it's something you can use in regards to arthritis, because you can put it on the joint, rub it on the joint, and it'll go directly into that joint. And DMSO is a facilitator of that. And it's also anti-inflammatory as well. I just wanted to throw that out there for anyone who might be dealing with that. And I think that is it. Go ahead.
The opioids.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah, I was just about to get to that. I just noticed it just before, as soon as I said that. Okay, so this one is from WRCD-TV, and this is FDA okays powerful opioid pill as an alternative to IV painkiller. So it says U.S. regulators approve fast-acting super potent opioid tablet as an alternative to IV painkillers in hospitals. So basically, they... they just created something that's even just as deadly or more deadly than the other opioids to replace it. And instead of you getting the IV, you just pop a pill. Just great. And pills are what started a lot of people's habits in the first place. yes. Food and Drug Administration. Go ahead, Jenna. Did you want to chime in on that?
Well, I think it was just a way to, if like you stated, it's stronger and faster acting. I think it's just a way to subjugate other suspected races to make sure that the ones up top are secure in their space. But I could be wrong.
Okay. Hey, that's not a bad illogical thought or idea, because they've been doing that a long time. So actually, I posted some videos about the history of money and different connections that they made between the Roman Empire and the Empire of the USA Inc., as Scotty says. And that was one of the things that they talk about, is distracting the people by keeping them drugged, by keeping them focused on the gladiator ring. They had a certain, I forget the name for it. They called it bread and something else. So there was a way it was, and they get into it, but we'll move on from that for now. But yes, this is just a refined way of continuing the old system under a new new auspices, I would say.
I would agree. To get this started off, what exactly is pro-black? I would like to go to this this one article just to get it started, and this comes from Atlanta sure. Black Star, and this come out today actually, and it goes gotcha.
Okay, great.
It goes gotcha. Woman swindles conservatives out of $150,000 after pretending to be a persecuted Trump supporter. She dubbed a self-dubbed reformed Republican is laughing all the way to the bank after swindling conservatives out of hundreds of thousands of dollars, thanks to her somewhat convincing sob story. The unnamed woman was unapologetic about her scheme that led hundreds of donors to dig deep in their pockets. After she claimed to have faced hardships and received a cold shoulder from family and friends when she came out as a supporter of Donald Trump. I will not hide any longer. Excuse me. Quote, I will not hide any longer. The left has made us feel as if us black Republicans should hide, but not anymore, unquote. Twitter user at Chickapeas wrote in a tweet dated October the 27th, alongside a photo of her sporting a red MAGA hat. In a follow-up tweet, she thanked everyone for their overwhelming support. After seeing this tweet, my parents cut me off and refused to pay my university tuition, she wrote. So if you can find it in your hearts to help a young black Republican pay for school, it will be appreciated. A woman posted screenshots of a text thread seemingly between her and her mother, where she complained about not being able to afford an apartment now that her mother has cut her off financially. I literally work part-time and can't find an apartment nor people to room with on such short notice, one text read. Mom, please, I don't know what to do. Why are you doing this to me? Because you're a fucking coon, her mother responds. Maybe one of these Trumpies that love you so much can take you in. The thread was enough to tug the folks' heartstrings. After posting a link to a now defunct GoFundMe page, the woman managed to collect about $150,000 from conservative donors. Now I'm gonna leave it there. Y'all can find that in our thread on BTR Community under the Real Life Radio page. But what this is that this young lady, just like I said, she swindled them out of some money. But I read that because it is so easy for these suspected racists to find young black men and women just like that, take them in and use them to help infiltrate whatever movement is going on in the black community. And what happened is, with this particular story, seems as if she already had it planned out how it was going to work, and whether she got what she was looking for or she got close to it, she made out with $150,000. I'm not sure what the repercussions is for that, if there's any. You know, they tend to make up laws for us once they find out.
Absolutely.
If we was trying to get them in some type of scheme. So hopefully she makes it out okay. But on the other end of that, it's a lot of people that fall in those categories and will come in and destroy whatever you have going on. And I think that was a very an important article, especially for tonight's topic, because, like I said, for people who, whether they voting for Trump or any other issue, just get dragged and dogged by us. We do it a lot. And then they fall in the arms of somebody else and then causes a major impact in a negative way. So I thought that was very important. And once again, if you're going to do something, do it to the suspects who do it to you. That's what I say. But what you think about that article, Roz?
I had to mute myself because I was laughing so hard as you were reading parts of it. It was just like hilarious, but it just goes to show that she had such a pulse on the psychology of how this country works that she knew. She had that foresight to say, hey, I could just make up this particular story. And like you said, I'll get these Republicans to respond. And of course they did. And a lot of times, if they can get a black person that's more confused than they could use to propagate their agenda in some way, $100,000 is nothing to them.
Nothing.
You know, to do that type of stuff. And essentially it's just a form of racial showcasing is what they'll use the person for, and they'll put them in whatever position they want them to be in order to have a black face on a particular issue, quote unquote. I think that she just had the pulse on the way the system works well enough to know that she could have come up with this elaborate story. But I mean, she really pulled out all the stops with the communications that she put together and all of that stuff in order to get them to do what they did. So yeah, you know, I just think that Minister Malcolm has always talked about race being that thermonuclear bomb that's going to really implode this country. And to me, the signs of that have never been more evident as far as that's concerned. And this story is a good example of that, just how the way that these types of different types of racial politics or color-based politics plays itself out or can sometimes play itself out. Yeah. So what else did you want to say about that? I found parts of it hilarious as the story got more and more elaborate, but I do know that she had to go about it the right way and be as convincing as possible in order to get the response she got. So that's where the deep multi-layered story with the emails or, communications back and forth go. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I think it is hilarious on the surface, but I also find a lot of danger within that story also, because as easy as it was for them to give her that money, because they, again, these suspects have no problem supporting each other or supporting us if we're willing to talk crazy, do crazy things to each other, or just, like you said, racial showcasing. But here's where the danger lies. They've been gotten, and it's been put out into the paper, on the internet and what have you. Now, what's going to happen to some of those young black children, men, women, that are feeling that way and they want to be black Republicans? What kind of danger does that put them in? Because that's going to be the first thing on a lot. That's the first thing on their minds to me immediately anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But now even more so, because they're going to be watching them that much closer. And you know it's always one of them, especially when they have the numbers, which if you're a black conservative, they normally have the numbers, that would just jump out and do something to them. You know,
you're
whether
right.
it's just bodily
you're
harm
correct.
or is major. And I think about that part of it too. So for any of you who are black conservatives, be careful. Because this young lady, as much as she has, you should be careful anyway, being around that particular crowd. But now that this young lady has made out with this money, it's going to be a lot more attention being paid. But with that being said, how you want to start this night off?
Let's see.
First video.
Yeah, let's go right into it, I guess.
All right, here we go.
Pro-black. I feel like a lot of people feel like pro-blackness is one very specific, kind of set thing. You know, kind of very stereotypical. You wear kente cloth and you burn incense and you, I don't know, I can't think of anything else right now, but, you know, like a very militant, more on the militant Pan-African side of things, which is perfectly fine if that's your version of what it means to be pro-black and if that's what you do and if that's what you aspire to do. Of course, that's fine. That's cool. But I feel like that's a very, you know, limited, narrow scope of pro-blackness and of what it means to be pro-black. And part of the, one of the reasons why I even made this channel was because I felt like there was a void in people that were talking about race and the kind of people that were talking about race and the kind of conversations that were being had. You know, I feel like, again, a lot of people feel like to be pro-black is this like one specific thing. And it's like, well, but what if I don't want to talk about race in that way? You know, one of my huge problems with the way that a lot of people talk about race, and I was just talking about this with somebody, was it on Instagram also or Tumblr? I don't know. I was just, or YouTube? I don't know. I was just talking about this with somebody, how one of my main huge problems, the way that people talk about race, is that people love to shroud race conversations in this academia and in this academic language, and, you know, they're like gatekeepers of you know, some type of secret knowledge, and if you don't have the secret knowledge, then you can't talk about race, you know? When Ferguson first happened, I'm trying to, like, read these articles and read these pieces and watch these think tanks and watch these political talks, and it's like, the conversations are going around and around in circles. You have people that are saying the same exact thing. They're using the same exact type of language. They're citing the same exact sources over and over. Half the time you watch these panels, and the panels are made up of white people, four white people, and one black guy, you know, three white men, one white woman, and one black guy. And, like, that's the panel to talk about race, right? Or, you know, you read an article and the article is, like, listing all these fucking sources that your average person doesn't have access to and can't read unless they have, you know, access to some type of LexisNexis or, you know, some type of academic search database. And, you know, the way that people talk about it, it was YouTube. It was YouTube. Because we were talking about the way that people talk about it on Twitter, like the elite black Twitter, talented 10th Twitter. You know, you have a lot of people that are extremely educated, you know, really smart, multiple degrees, that talk about race in a certain way, right? And that's fine. That's great for what it is. And again, that's great if that's your version of being pro-black. But, you know, when Ferguson was happening, I wanted to talk to people about race the same way that we talk about music, the same way that we talk about art, the same way that we talk about fashion. You know, I felt like I could log on YouTube and I could find a million vlogs and blogs of people talking about art and music and fashion in a certain type of way, in a very, you know, conversational tone, cursing, we nigga this, nigga that, you know, just talking the way that we talk to one another. But I couldn't find any of those types of videos when it came to talking about race. I couldn't find any of those types of videos when it came to talking about being pro-black. I couldn't find any of those types of videos when it came to, you know, black empowerment. All that stuff was, like, in this, like, one little, like, narrow box. And if I didn't want to get in that box, then I, like, wasn't pro-black. I, like, wasn't in bed with the pro-black people. Which is why I started making videos in the first place. Because I was just like, I want to talk about this type of stuff the same exact way that I talk about everything else. I don't want to feel like, even though I did go to college and I am college educated and this, that, and the third, I don't want to feel like I'm sitting in a fucking lecture hall every time we talk about race. I don't want to feel like I have to police myself and police my language and police my tone and not curse and not do this and not do that when we talk about race. Because you also have people, less now, again, since Ferguson, but when Ferguson had first started, you had this, like, overly politically correct, again, these conversations and these panels. And I remember going on YouTube one time and, like, watching this discussion and going to the comments, and the comments were full of angry black people, right? Like, incensed, like, outraged black people talking about, they're not even talking about anything. They're going around and around in circles. Everyone's being politically correct. No one wants to say what we're all thinking, which is, like, that this is fucked up, you know? No one wants to say that people are racist. No one, you know, there was this whole attitude of, And I mean, and there still is. People have this attitude about everything of, well, both sides are right and both sides have valid points. And no, that's bullshit. I'm telling you right now, that's bullshit. Sometimes people are wrong. Sometimes people are wrong. Sometimes one side is right. Sometimes one side is wrong. Not every side has to be right all the time, especially when we're talking about fucking race and police brutality, okay? Like, sometimes one side is right and one side is wrong. And you watch these panels and you watch these debates and these discussions with these mediators, and it's, oh, you guys are both right. That was the one that I saw that I vividly remember. It was this white guy and this black guy talking, and this white woman was a mediator. And, you know, the black guy, he's angry, he's upset, he's passionate, he's saying, you know, these are the stats, this is what's going on with black people in this country. And then you have the white guy talking a whole bunch of, like, white bullshit. And then at the end, you have the white woman say, oh, well, this was a great discussion, you both were right, you both made great points, this, this, and this. And the people in the comment section were angry. They were like, I don't want to hear this. People want to hear something real. They wanted to hear something real. They wanted to hear something authentic. They wanted to hear something they could understand, not something that was couched in all this academic language and all this political correctness and both sides are right and we're not going to curse and we're not going to do this and we're not going to do that. So, which is why I really appreciate comments where people say, my videos are raw, they're real, they're understandable, it's plain, it's easy for everyone to understand the concepts that I'm talking about. I got a really, really great message the other day saying, you know, I love watching your, from a girl, younger girl, I love watching your videos, I feel like I'm, you know, talking to my woke, you know, big sister, because that's like the point. And I feel like that is my personal brand of pro-blackness, right? Like, real shit. Shit that everybody thinks, shit that everybody wants to say, but they feel like they can't. Shit that everybody can understand. Easy, you know, I'm not trying to be smarter than anybody, or, you know, and just getting back to the original thing with this comment this girl left on my Instagram, it's just like people have these ideas about pro-blackness and what it means to be pro-black, what it means to be a black-owned business, what it means to be conscious, you know, kind of going back to my video about Wale and Janelle Monáe and yoga and the girls on drugs. And it's like, if you don't fit into those boxes, people want to say you're not pro-black or you're not this or you're not that. And I feel like that's dumb, stupid, you know, like, I just feel like my pro-black is probably not going to be the same as yours. And I looked up a couple definitions, so I have some definitions here. My phone. Pro-black. What is your definition of being pro-black? This was one that I liked a lot. When you actively seek out ways to improve the condition of black people. I liked that one. You know, when you care about black people as a whole, as a unit, as a collective, and not necessarily just about you, you're one person, or you're, you know, one, you know, nuclear family, or your friends, but when you're thinking about what's going on as a whole, when you're thinking about the systems and the institutionalized racism and things like that, and trying to figure out ways to hopefully improve the condition of black people as a whole, I feel like that's a great definition. I know you guys can hear that, sorry. You know, people that care about other black people, that love and support other black people, you know, black men that love black women that love black men, you know, just like, I'm pro-black. I'm for everything black. I want to improve the condition of black people. I want to buy everything from black people. I want to just live in my own black world, you know? And that is what being pro-black is to me. Like, I'm trying to actively improve shit for my people and deal with the shit that's being thrown my way in terms of racism and staying woke and remaining conscious and remaining aware and fighting institutionalized racism and trying to make shit better for my future kids that I will be having. You know, all that falls under being pro-black, and none of that has to do with the way that I talk, the way that I dress, the way that I wear my hair, you know, none of it. I feel like...
Okay, well, right before we get into that, I would like to go ahead on and read a couple of these definitions, that this one that I found. And it goes...
Sure.
Pro-black is a lifestyle that encouraged the economic growth and development of the black people as a whole, with a purpose of increasing the wealth and population of black people around the world. Whether it be spending money with black-owned businesses in your communities or online, promoting love for black people, and encouraging black youth, is its sole purpose to keep and uplifting black people in America to be proud, and at the same time, excuse me, they wrote that wrong. Sole purpose to keep uplifting black people in America to be proud at the same time. Okay, the second definition is to be in high support of African-American black people, having a preference of black people without bashing white people or those of other minorities. And the third definition didn't even have a definition. It just said pro-black, not anti-white. So those are some the three definitions that I found, which came out of the Urban Dictionary. I couldn't find it nowhere else outside of people's perception of what pro-black is. So go ahead, Brother Rice.
I think it was good to get a young person's perspective, because she's young. And when she was talking about being able to talk about race just in everyday language and just make things plain, kind of like, you know, the intro music for our show, when Minister Malcolm talks about speaking the language where everybody can understand. And that was really good. And it kind of reminded me of when there was a famous video of Tupac, and he was talking to the New Africa movement. They had like the gathering, and he was there, and he was cursing, and he was just kind of really incensed. I think like not too long before that, there was another incident, and he was kind of just going in on just being tired of being abused and mistreated, and black people hating themselves and mistreating each other. And at one point he said, you know, a lot of people were mad that I'm cursing, you know, but you should be mad about the conditions we in, not about the language that I'm using to speak about it. He's like, if you mad about the language I'm speaking about it, then something's wrong, because you should be angry like I'm angry, you know. And sometimes we have to allow room for that. It's just not something you do, I think, should be done in certain settings. I think there's a time and place for everything. But yes, there is times when things just get you incensed. You just might need to just be able to say exactly what you feel in the moment, you know, with and have that conversation. Of course, I was in a codified manner with other black people that, you know, if you all are discussing a particular situation or whatever the case may be. But also, when she talked about this narrow vision of what being pro-black is, and the definitions that she read, the definitions you read, coincide with the way that I feel. It was the way that I was brought up, you know, as far as just my parents made it quite clear that wherever I could spend money with my people, do that first. You know, my parents always told me, make sure I came home with a black woman. Like, these were things that I grew up with all the time. You know, and even for a long time, I had a narrower vision of what pro-black was. Some of it I got from Dr. Ben, just being around him, because he had a lot of things to say about what he thought pro-blackness was. And it was based on his heritage and the types of people that he came up around, which would be Detroit Red and then Malcolm X later on, Dr. Clark and other numerous scholars. But he also came up on the streets of Harlem. So he had that connection to people on the streets, and he had the direct connection to academia and that type of stuff as well. That's honestly where I think I got that more narrow perception of what being pro-black was. But as I got older and I just encountered different black people from different walks of life, you know, you just start to realize that there's just people out there that may not be have the same background as you, same upbringing as you, or even same position on a lot of issues as you, but they love their people. And that is what should trump everything, is the content of a person's character and what they're actually doing. you know, what the things that they do should coincide with what they say their perception of being pro-black is. Now, a lot of the things that we heard about what pro-black is as far as the meanings that were read coincide with a lot of the things that I've done and a lot of the ways that I've raised my son. My wife and I have raised our son as far as just that ability to love black people, love yourself. And this is stuff he heard from a baby. It wasn't anything that where he was on his own. And then at some point, we started to understand. This was stuff he got from birth, pretty much, which I think was the best thing because it made it a lot easier for him. There was a lot of he experienced where there were a lot of other young black children when they were going to white circles or when he went to high school and he went to a very white high school. Sometimes the black children intimidated to be around these people, and he was never intimidated because he knew who he was. But long before he got to that situation, and he knew that his history didn't start with slavery. So he walked in there with a whole different understanding, and a lot of times he would end up teaching other students and sometimes some of his own teachers. And that's how much he understood about himself long before he got there due to the work that we did at home with him. So I think that what she addressed as most important is being able to broaden our scope on what we perceive pro-blackness to be. And like there's an article I posted in there. It's actually one of the first ones I posted in the thread and says that pro-black means all black people. So in other words, you know, if you love black people, you got to love all black people. And it doesn't mean that some people aren't going to incense you and that you're just stupid and non-thinking about things. It just means that you allow room for people to have other perceptions, thoughts and ideas, because sometimes it's those other thoughts and ideas that may work in dealing with certain issues we deal with. They may not be things you like or things that might resonate with you, but they may work. So you have to be open enough to at least hear the person out. Even if you say, no, I don't want to do things your way, at least you give them that opportunity to get that idea out, because you never know. It might not be the whole idea. It might be a part of the idea that would work. And you say, yeah, I don't like everything, you know, you're bringing forward, but these couple of things, actually, I think we can expand on that and maybe add some things to that and start making moves. And you can actually have like a think tank. And that's where throwing the emotion out of the window comes into play. And Dr. Welson talked about that regularly. Neely Fuller talked about that regularly. Dr. Marimba Ani talks about that regularly, like really putting the emotions aside and focusing as a scientist, emotions. A counter-racist scientist is how Dr. Welson would say it. And scientists are not emotional. They go there with an express purpose. They have an experiment, and there's just a certain way you have to do things, and it has nothing to do with emotion. It just has to do with getting the correct result. And then once you get the correct result, you find a means to repeat those results over and over and over to confirm that whatever it is you're doing is right and exact.
Well, emotions.
And that's the way we should approach white supremacy, in my opinion, which coincides with these grand elders and now grand ancestors that listen to and are taught by and have been our genders for countless decades now. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
But emotions, I think that's a big part of it. But before I jump into my part of what I got from the video, Brother Scotty, how are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm not on the board.
Hey, I'm doing okay. But no, you go ahead, man. You know, you're the host or the co-host, so you go ahead. I can wait.
Oh.
Hey, Scotty.
Thank
how
you.
How you doing? Peace, love, Scotty.
Well, emotions is the biggest part that I got from that, because she was getting emotional just talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime this particular issue comes up, most people do get emotional. And I believe it's because they don't have a definition for themselves. It's always what they've heard or what somebody showed them. And it's never the same thing. It's different for everybody. What I think about when I think about pro-blackness, and it's, I'm not sure what the, because we talked about this off of the air, and we talked about in the past how it come about. But when I think about it now, I see that it's a small cult that's been built to not actually exercise what Stokely Carmichael started with the Black Power movement, but it's to ostracize other black people that don't conform to what they're saying at that particular time. Whether we, most time we talking about pro-blackness, we are talking about interracial relationships. That's normally the number one thing in how somebody can't be pro-black because of that. Now that is the opinion of whoever has that opinion. But my question is, outside of that one thing, what else is the criteria for being pro-black? Is it respecting yourselves and your children and your family? Is it, like she stated, practicing black economics, trying as best as possible to purchase items from black businesses? Is it black self-respect, where you're greeting every black person that you initially meet, because you can't continue to do it all the time, because just like anybody else, we have fools that we run into that look just like us. But initially, are we approaching them with a smile, not always snapping on each other? Are we trying to talk to the youth that's around our neighborhood? Are we trying to talk to the elders that sometimes have no sense? Are we trying to talk to them? Are we learning about our history? Are we preparing for the future? These are the type of things that I wonder, but they never come up in conversation. So it's a myriad of things that could go on, but for the most part, what I see is that it's a very divisive issue, because nobody has a clear definition whatsoever. Now, I could be wrong, but Brother Scotty, thanks for showing up tonight. How are you?
I'm doing the best I can.
Hey, Brother Scotty, how you doing?
All right. I tend to agree that there are probably several definitions, but, you know, you said that you looked for one, or you might have asked somebody and they couldn't give you one. But I'm sure somebody can make something up for you, you know what I'm saying? Make up something and tell you. So I'm sure there's several definitions out there. And so then that's why dictionaries are important, man, because it's like universal words that we have all been taught and agreed upon to use. This, you know, well, we ain't got no choice in the language that we're using. We're in a country that speaks English, American English, and what have you. But, you know, when people start making up their own definitions for existing words, or they make up terms, you know, it's always good to get their definition. And then it's up to you to, you know, decide if that definition makes any sense to you or holds any logic or whatever. But in a system of, I would argue that in a, just for the sake of argument's sake, you know, for a discussion, I would say you can't be pro-black in a system if you believe the system is a system of white supremacy, meaning white people are in control, white people are on top, they are dominating the entire planet. So what do it matter if you're pro-black or not, if you ain't got no power? You know what I'm saying? How can you be pro-black in a system of white supremacy? It don't work that way. You know what I'm saying? So in terms of, and I wish I had come across Mr. Fuller, let's say even in my 30s, man, you know, I'm in my 50s now. I probably came across him 10 years ago in my 40s, and some of his concepts, which after, you know, listening to some of his concepts for a while, man, is basically some of the same stuff other people have said, like Malcolm X and what have you. So when we talk about pro-blackness and we say, well, what's some pro-black icons? People might say Malcolm X, right? But they'll give you the Nation of Islam Malcolm X, but they won't give you the Organization for African-American Unity Malcolm X. They won't give you the humanitarian Malcolm X, who stated that, you know, I was kind of wrong by saying that people based on the color of their skin were devils or, you know, that's what defines a human being. So I was kind of wrong on that. And I work with anybody as long as you're trying to improve or change this miserable condition that exists on this earth. I think Mr. Fuller said it the simplest, and I play his clip from time to time where he said, you can be pro-black, you can be pro-American, you can be pro-French, pro-British, Afrocentric, whatever you want to identify yourself as or label yourself as, none of that matters if you ain't pro-justice. He says if you don't believe Absolutely. In justice. So rather than in behind the enemy lines, if I'm maintaining my codification, not when I'm just having a conversation among the brothers and the sisters, you know, but if let's say I'm engaging in people activity area, today is November 6th, election day. So I would want to have a plug. If I was running for office or I was trying to get somebody to support somebody that's running for office, support their policies, I wouldn't say I'm pro-black in my policy. I'm pro-justice. If it just happens to be black people the most, since it's a system of white supremacy, then I'm pro-black too. I'm pro-justice. Pro-justice covers it all. Like Mr. Fuller said.
Yep.
None of these things matter if you don't believe in practicing justice, because then that means you believe in mistreating people. So I would just simply say in a codification, I'm pro-justice.
That is excellent.
Hey, we've reached the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back after these quick commercial breaks. Capra, if you would like to add anything, have a question or comment for me, myself, Brother Rise, or just add into the conversation, once again, by all means, give us a call. That number is 704-802-5056. That number again is 704-802-5056. Press **. Put yourself in the queue, and we'll be with you as soon as possible. Brother Scotty, that was excellent. I was going to get into that mistreatment that you were talking about, because that tends to be what ends up happening. We say things, whether we mean them or not, and what I come to find out is that a lot of times we don't mean them. These things rarely get said to the people that they are referencing, but it just sounds good whether they on the internet, or in a crowd of people. So I know that numbers make people feel a lot bigger, and they say a lot of things that they wouldn't say on their own. And once again, that divisiveness, that's one of the things that we're going to have to stop. But I know you had something you wanted to, you had a rebuttal for Scotty, Brother Rise. Go ahead.
Oh, no, it wasn't a rebuttal. I thought it was like excellent. I thought what he said was great, because that should always be the focus. You know, I've never been a person to call myself pro-black or Afrocentric or anything. In the context of conversation, if the subject came up, it would be spoken about, in those terms, as far as supporting black people, treating black people with respect, being patient with black people, all of those things will fall under the auspices of how I function. But I've never termed it that per se. I just don't like labels. I think labels can be very narrowing and confining. So yeah, I think what he said is the most accurate and most important thing is to be about justice, because that's really what we're trying to do. When it's all said and done, that's what we're trying to do.
That's
what we should be trying to do, I should say, because maybe some of us aren't really about justice. But I would say, in my opinion, that's what the focus should be. But go ahead, Dennis.
No, I was saying that's what a lot of people say, is that they're looking for justice. But when you see their actions and how they speak, you find that they just want to be the one to put the foot on your neck, whether it's you, a suspected yeah. racist, or anybody else. Instead of us having our the foot on our necks, they want to be the foot. That's what I tend to find out the deeper in conversation you get. And I'm not saying that they don't have a reason to feel that way. I just would like to know that up front. That's all.
I think Brother Dave used to describe it as, you don't want the system to end. You just want to be the one at the most beneficial place in the system. And like you said, it's basically, I want to replace the white man's foot. And yeah, so some of us do think that way. Some of us really do. And those are things we have to look out for. And that's the importance of not getting wrapped up in color politics, where everything has to be about, you know, one specific group of people, and, you know, everybody else is you know, out. It's like, it's just another form of tribalism that just doesn't really make sense. And once you start to really understand history, like I said before, like, just understand the history of the way things happen, and understand that, you know, do some Mexicans come here, let's say, for example, and practice some form of racism towards black people or don't like us? Yes. But also, Mexico has a history of being a sanctuary for our ancestors. There's a huge Afro-Mexican community that is highly in touch with their African heritage and are fighting for more recognition. These are people we can make connections with as other diasporans, so that, let's say, if something did hit the fan and things got really bad, we might be able to go where they are. They might say, hey, you know, you have a safe spot, you can come. All of these things are possible if we're thinking people, because a lot of people understand what has happened to us in this country. And I mean, even Dave talked about this recently on Tando, that there was an incident a number of years ago where they had black military hostages that they released in Iran. And they actually said to those soldiers, we know what black people have been through. We understand racism and white supremacy has been practiced on your people for hundreds of years. So, I mean, they made that a part of their understanding and discussion with these particular soldiers. So there's people outside of this country that really understand. Just like when that video with Brother Polite, when he went to Ghana, they have a whole museum dedicated to American Africans. There's Malcolm X on the wall, Phillips Wheatley on the wall, W.E.B. Du Bois, Kwame Ture, you name it. There's a huge museum with nothing but American Africans telling our story. But yet, if you listen to some groups, some tribal groups in this country, they'll tell you Africans hate us. They don't, you know, they're disrespectful and blah, blah, blah. There's screwed up people in every group of people. But you have to really, and that's another thing about traveling, the incredible wealth of knowledge you can get when you travel. Some of the things that I've heard some of our people say that is just so separatist, and they'll be the quote unquote the pro black folks, and they'll just say the most separatist things. And I'm like, have you traveled at all? Because a lot of what you say, and it's not saying that, like I said, that it's not true in some capacity, but this blanket, you know, blanket assessment of one group of people is completely inaccurate. It just doesn't coincide with contemporary history or older history. So these are all things that we have to get into perspective and really kind of, and that's why I say the prayer at the end of the show, being patient with other black people. These are all things that I do. These are things my family says. We say it together. It's something that I try to live every day, coming from a background where I was quite anti-black as a young person and quite angry and quite violent. So this is just a way of making sure that these things stay in the forefront of my mind all the time. And that's just my way of doing things. Other people might have other ways of doing those types of things, but that's just the way that I choose to do it, because I find those words to be powerful things, because words are important. Go ahead, Jenna.
No, I'm agreeing with you 100%. I know that I try to share the information that I come in contact with and just have that be that free space. It could be something as little as just listening, because we've had right. many shows where we talk about the depression that a lot of us don't never want to acknowledge, and just being that listening ear to be able to get some of that stress out of their body. You know, that's one way. Sharing some of the books that I'm into, that I'm currently reading or have read, just to give a different perspective. You stated that you was quite anti-black when you was younger. Well, I think that was purposeful. I think a lot of us were. And it's not by coincidence. You know, just thinking as we get older and start learning more about this system of white supremacy, after your eyes have been open to what's going on, you cannot see it. You know, I have a 6-year-old son that spots out everything. So, and
yes,
so we
does.
Are constantly, we are constantly having conversations, constantly. My daughter's too, but my son more specifically, because he has that same rage that I have. He has to deal with things on a different level than I had to do, because I didn't know anything about this. And that could be somebody's definition of what I remember. Listening to Tupac, and he was stating that we as black men have a short window span of showing massive aggressiveness as men. And I think the ages he gave was like 16 to 30, I believe that was what it was. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. when I heard him say that, It made sense to me, because those are the years that if you do have children, they are very young and you have very little responsibilities for most of us. But after that, you know, you got to make sure that you on time to work if you're not an entrepreneur. So you have to bend to somebody else's will. Not to say that you didn't have to do that at first, but if you're going to take care of your children or you're going to be a grown woman or a grown man, you have to be willing to do these things to provide for your children. But the only thing that you don't have to stop doing is passing that information along to get your children ready, so that when they hit this system of white supremacy with their eyes wide open, they already have resources that they can use for whatever situation occurs. But a lot of us don't do that either. Hate to say it, I have a huge family, and none of them mentioned white supremacy to me. And they was fighting it on a regular basis down here in the South. But they never gave that to us as children. Now, that could be because they wanted us to be safe. As far as our thought process, they could have wanted to let us be children for a little bit longer. I know that's one of the phrases that my mother used to tell me all the time. You be a child as long as possible, because you got the rest of your life to be an adult. But the fact of the matter is that living within this system, we're always considered adults. You know, a 30-year-old white man can be considered a child. But a 12-year-old black boy is a grown man. And when we start thinking in these terms, I mean, not these terms, but when we start thinking with this ideology, your thought process changes. And sometimes it turns into rage. And more times than not, with us being the lowest on the totem pole, we end up taking it out on ourselves. But yet, that term...
You know, it's funny.
Pro-blackness will still come out right when they're kicking you in your teeth. I just don't understand sometimes. And if anybody's listening that have some input, by all means, y'all give us a call. That number is 704 802 5056. Press ** to open your mic, and we'll be with you as soon as possible. Go ahead, Roz. My apologies.
Yeah, I'm sorry for interjecting, but what you said just kind of sparked a memory because, you know, I, like I said, I came up around some of our greatest scholars, and even with that, I still ended up running the street. And a lot of it just came from the problems within the household, within the family. But one thing I do remember was, and I was around 13 years old. And at that point I was already, you know, reading books like The Destruction of Black Civilization and whatnot. I just started junior high school. And, I remember like at one point it just dawned on me that like I was born into a system that was just so screwed up and rigged. And I think a big part of it was because, the term white supremacy wasn't an in vogue term in my family. So it would, sometimes the discussions would center around the system of white supremacy, but it wasn't presented in that way explicitly. Whereas like now I have the language, and my son came up around a lot of this language. So he has a different type of advantage. And also the fact that his mother and I have been together his whole life. Whereas, you know, my parents split when I was extremely young. So, you know, I even look at all of that, and you're right. What happens is you get angry. And if you don't have any sort of agenda or an adult or a parent that's able to help channel that anger into something constructive, you know, it's easy to get wrapped up in negativity, even though you might be a person that is really intelligent and you know, you could talk to about African history or whatever the case may be. And the person will still get caught up in, you know, the regular trappings and traps of what society has to offer our youth in particular. So, yeah, I just thought that was quite important. And
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I think I wanted to get into the second video because I want to kind of get into some of the origins of where this stuff comes from as far as just our inabilities to sometimes work with one another, deal with each other and get along. Because we'll find that a lot of this behavior that we exhibit towards each other, some of us today, has antecedents in times past. So it's really almost like we're not learning from the things that caused downfalls of our ancestors to put us in the situation we're in the first place. Like we're not picking up that understanding that, wait a minute, we're repeating a lot of the same things here.
We'll get right on into that.
So go ahead.
We'll get right on into that. But we also have to always remember a lot of this stuff was taken away from us and deliberately pushed off. So, you know, we're in the information age and things are coming out. And hopefully this will keep us prepared. Now, I got this queued up. Now, where did you want to start this, right from the beginning?
From the beginning, yeah, because it's only about, I think, like 10 minutes or something.
I got you.
I'm
going right into it.
Okay, cool.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, I'm honored that you asked me to come.
That's wonderful.
Appreciate it.
That's wonderful.
Yes,
and we've seen some of the work that you've been doing over these years, and it seems to me that the first thing we should ask you is, how do you remain so consistent? Because it seems that so many people do their best work at some period, and then what they end up doing is simply trying to relive that work instead of doing more work.
Well, first I want to say something to the ladies in the audience. I want you ladies to understand that African women, and you're the genetic reproductions of our mothers, were considered the most beautiful women on the planet for thousands of years by all of the civilized people of the world. The Greeks thought so much of your beauty that they named two star constellations after you, Andromeda and Cassiopeia. The two most beautiful star constellations that are in the heavens. They say that they have all of the beauty of the setting sun, hair which is alive, and a figure incomparable even today. So I don't want you to think that just because we went through 400 years of horror where they were saying you were ugly, that you believe that, because you're the most beautiful people, because you are imitated by everybody. So I want to say that before we get on to the discussion.
That's right.
That's right.
Incredible.
In answer to your question,
yes.
And you saw that because I'm old, I forgot the question.
His memory's better than mine.
It's an ongoing process.
Right.
One thing led to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I did the video called The Songhai Princess, I was really testing whether or not drama really worked, because I had found out that drama is the only thing that changes attitude,
mm-hmm.
and attitude changes behavior.
Right.
So in 1990, I created a little video, almost animated, about a little Songhai princess that was kidnapped by the Wicked Witch of the Mountain, and she was rescued by her lover, who was a medical student at Sankore University. Now, but all during the film, they saw the beautiful homes our mothers and fathers lived in West Africa. They saw the beautiful buildings, the universities. So all of this was subliminal. The impact on children was so great that I said, we've got to do a major motion picture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we are doing now. We're producing a major motion picture called Whispers of the Medallion. So it's an ongoing process.
That's right. The reason. That's right. Mm-hmm. So many people get sidetracked. It seems like you don't get sidetracked, though. You're focused on
There's a reason for that. And the reason is called a territorial imperative.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
I hate to ask this question because it's embarrassing. How many of you who are African Americans, how many of you know the African city and country from which your ancestors were born? Except my daughter.
Not one hand went up.
Not one hand went up.
Mm-mm.
I asked this question of 500 whites. How many of you know the city and country? I was teaching at a white university just outside Philadelphia. Every hand went up. They knew not only the country from which they came, not only the city, but the borough from which their ancestors came. Now, how come they know and none of you know? Here's the reason. And here's the reason why I am different. The reason is that these South Carolina and North Carolina plantation owners went to Germany to find out how they could control our fathers and mothers on the plantation, because they were getting out of hand. They were burning the houses down. They were killing white folk. They were doing everything negative about being in captivity. They were never slaves. They were prisoners of war, the War of 1591. So what happened was they sought the advice of an expert in Songhai history. Now, his name was Johann Blumenbach, and he was the head of the Department of History at the University of Göttingen in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
How many of you know this? I know you was taught this in college and everything, all you college folks. Mm-hmm. Well, when they sought his advice,
right. Mm-hmm.
They said, do they know that they're the Songhai people? So the plantation owners who traveled over there to seek his advice said, well, of course they know that they come from the great Songhai Empire. Well, that's your problem. You can't let them know that they came from greatness, from grandeur, from beauty, from sophistication. You'll never be able to control them. So the plantation owner said, well, how can we prevent it? I mean, the mothers and the fathers would tell the children, say, you came from Timbuktu, and you came from the city of Jane, and that's where we were born. And then the Europeans came over and invaded us in 1591 and marched us to the seas, to the waiting ship. Said, man, you can't allow them to teach that to their children.
Mm.
They said, well, how you want to stop it? Here's how you do it. Here's why you don't know where you're from. Blumenbach said, what you do, as soon as a boatload arrives, take the babies out the mama's arms, send the parents to a distant plantation and work them to death, and raise the children to believe they came from a jungle. They won't know the difference.
That's right.
How would they know?
That's right.
Their parents are gone. Yeah, now, here's the difference between me and you. When they captured my grandmother, I'm not going through, you heard the beginning of the story. My grandfather was a lawyer and a sculptor in Benin City, Nigeria. And the English kept on coming over stealing his sculpture.
Wow.
Some of his sculpture ended up at the Art Museum in West Philadelphia, where they came to show it off because it was world-class sculpture.
So you have you been able to see this sculpture?
Oh, sure.
Wow.
Yeah, we've got some in the book.
Incredible.
But anyhow, what happened was his wife hassled him and said, don't fight the English when they come over. Just let them have the sculpture. I'm pregnant. And they'll kill you. Then I'll be a widow. And they'll put me on board ship and take me over there where they're taking all the rest of those prisoners of war. But my grandfather, whose name was Mwale.
Mwale.
Said, I'm fighting them. I'm not going to let them steal my sculpture anymore. And he gathered some of his fellow sculptors. And they fought the English when they came over to steal. They were always stealing some. And they killed him. Of my grandfather and put his wife, his pregnant wife, my great-great-great-grandmother on board the ship. And the ship was named Jesus, by the way. That's deep. That's deep. I've been angry ever since. Well, at Jesus. I mean, not at Jesus, but at Jesus. And on the way over, the baby was born.
Wow.
All right? Name of Diane. She named Diane. Now, it was bound for South Carolina. How many of your ancestors came from South Carolina? Raise your hand.
Oh, boy.
A whole bunch of folks. They were bound for South Carolina. But in 1808, this was 1813, in 1808, a law was passed by Congress forbidding more importations of the Songhai people. We're Songhai people.
Right.
See, Blumenbach said, don't allow them to even learn that they came from the Songhai Empire.
Right. We're going to try to breed them here on this continent
rather
than continuing the cultural memory.
They don't even let them learn the name Songhai because then they'll start investigating. Then take away their ability to read and write, pass laws against them learning to read and write. Then they can't learn anything about the Songhai Empire. And they passed the law, 200 years of law, not allowing blacks to learn to read and write. Well, anyhow, in 1808, this law was passed forbidding any more importations of Songhai people. Now, nobody paid any attention to that law at all except one little group called abolitionists. Now, the abolitionists put their money together and they bought a ship. And they patrolled the seas looking for prisoner of war ships, which you all were trained to say slave ships. They weren't slave ships. They were prisoner of war ships.
Very important.
Well, coming, very important distinction.
That's right.
And when we teach our children, they were never slaves.
That's
they
right.
were children, descendants of prisoners of war.
Mm-hmm.
Like McLean. He
That's
was
right.
a prisoner of war.
That's right.
He wasn't a slave.
That's right.
He got captured by the enemy.
That's right.
On the way, this abolitionist ship captured the ship that my great-great-grandmother was on. So instead of this baby being taken from my arms in South Carolina, the ship was towed to Trenton, New Jersey. And of course, Nzinga, who was the baby's mother, my great-great-great-grandmother, taught the baby that her father was a world-class sculptor, that her father was a lawyer, that he went to world-class universities. So I was trained from babyhood, you know, that we've got to right this wrong.
That's right.
That's right.
So I was, you know, it's your job. because you were spared by just an act of God, an act of the ancestors, to not let the baby being taken from Nzinga's arms. And the baby grew up, and she had a child. Her name is Mary Diane Thomas, and she was my great-grandmother, and she helped raise me.
Wow.
And so she told me the story when I was a kid. You see, so that's how I know
wow.
where we're from.
Wow.
That's right.
Now, that goes into something that we had talked about a couple shows back where most of us don't know. Now, I know not everybody, and right now it's a lot of people that don't believe in DNA evidence and what have you, but a lot of us don't know where we come from. And I've never thought of it in that manner. So that was a great video. I appreciate that, Brother Roz. That was very interesting. Brother Roz, you on mute?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, that he's now an ancestor. He passed away in 2012. That's Dr. Edward Robinson. And
take us to the break real quick, Roz, and we'll jump right back into this.
All right, you are now live on air with Real Life, the radio show, with myself, Roz, and my co-host, Jenna Kepra. I just got an echo back. I'm sorry. Yes, you're now live on Real Life, the radio show, with myself, Roz, and my co-host, Jenna Kepra, on Foundational Radio, as well as being broadcast by and on Black Talk Radio Network. Thanks for being with us this Tuesday evening. If you do wish to ask a question or make a comment, please give us a call at 704-802-5056. Again, that's 704-802-5056. Press star if you wish to ask a question or make a comment.
That's amazing.
Yes, he was 93. Yeah, that was on 2011. He was 93. And he passed away, I believe it was June of 2012. And man, he was like a living library of knowledge and information. And one thing that he talked about was the use of theater to infuse better understanding and positive infusion of love of self to our children. And that is... Basically, he was taken back to the seven liberal arts because that really started in the Nile Valley. They developed plays, what they would call passion plays. That's what they would call them in Greece. And what they would do is basically evoke emotion towards a particular deity through storytelling and acting. And that ended up becoming a worldwide phenomenon, even to the development of film. And what he was able to see was the horrific effect on the psyche of Black people that the television and motion pictures and media was having on the minds of children. And he wanted to make media to have the opposite effect.
Right.
And one of the things he talks about is this. Go ahead.
Propaganda.
Yes. And the thing he made clear was that the level of self-hatred that we display with each other, and he would always give statistics of how many Black people were killed and what number of those people were killed by other Black people. And he directly saw the positive effects of these children having access to media that it showed them in the true light, in a positive light, in a, rather than in this pigeonhole, everything that you see about Black people is negative, everything you see about white people is positive. And he saw that, and he discusses that in some of his other videos. And I think it's profound. I'm going to say this now because I think it was really interesting. He didn't get to talk about it in this particular clip. But what he said was when they took that, when the abolitionists, these were all white abolitionists, took over that ship that had his great-great-great-grandmother on it, and they brought them to Trenton, New Jersey, all of those people, as including especially the ones that had children, the women with children, were housed and kept by white abolitionists, including his grandmother. So they did not grow up on the plantation because they grew up under the protection of these different white families. Each one of them basically adopted these captured people, and they, that was how they were able to maintain their family structure and, of course, pass on their family history because, like you said, they didn't rip his great-great-grandmother from his great-great-great-grandmother's arms. They came to Trenton, New Jersey. But in another video, he discusses the fact that they were, each of those people who were captured on that ship were adopted by white abolitionists who allowed them to grow up in basically as free as they could be in the state of New Jersey.
Now, that's interesting because when we have these conversations, that part of the story normally gets left out. And I'm a big...
Yeah, he discussed it, but it's just not in this video.
Right. I'm just saying, I'm a big proponent of giving the whole story.
True.
And it mm-hmm. tends to get left out. And what I like to do is take advantage of every opportunity that's presented to me. It may not seem right to everyone, but if I can get some help, I will accept it. But I know a lot of people who won't, especially if they feel that it's coming from a suspected racist. They don't want no help whatsoever. At least that's what they'll say in the company of other Black people.
Yep, I've heard that before.
So we run.
And so that's. Well, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Ross.
No, I'm just saying that's another part to the story, to his life story. He just didn't get to discuss it in that particular clip. Now.
Right, so it's literally impossible to tell.
I think that a lot of times, because that term pro-Black is a term that's basically a vernacular term, it's not a dictionary term. It's something that was vernacularly created, I think, loosely amongst Black people to try and describe an abstract concept. So you have, you know, you can have 10 people in the room and each one of them will give you a different meaning for what pro-Black is to them. So I think, like Scotty was saying earlier, defining definitions, if that comes up as a topic, is really good. But I just think that a lot of times I think American Africans have become what I would call ideological tribalists. So you have tribalism amongst us based on ideologies. And if one group of people doesn't like or doesn't resonate completely with another group of people's ideology, then they become the other that looks like you. And we aren't able to disagree about specific ideologies yet coalesce around the system of white supremacy. It's got to be with me all the way, including whatever aspect of my ideology you don't deal with. You have to be with all of that, or it's nothing. And that has been our detriment and will continue to be our detriment. We don't have to all get along. We don't all have to agree. But when it comes to what we're dealing with collectively, we should be able to agree on that. And we should also be able to agree that we will not mistreat each other in the quest to solve the problem.
And let me
and that should just be a code. Go ahead.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I repeatedly asked a question about what our code should be. A lot of us well, excuse me, not a lot of us, but I have been in a few circles to where I hear the term, they study white people the same way white people study us. And I think that's something that we all should do, especially when we're being terrorized by them, as well as ourselves, but on a systematic level by them mostly. When are we going to start co-opting different tactics that they used on us? Because I believe that that will be the next step in the code, whether it's deception, like the young lady practiced on the first article that I read. Just all of the people area activities, just co-opting them. I know just not too long ago, there was a lot of black people getting mad because a white woman that was kneeling because that kneeling was supposed to be for the unjustified murder of black and brown children, and she was kneeling in, I believe, for feminism, maybe. I can't remember what she was kneeling for, but she co-opted that because that's what was going on at that particular time. Wouldn't it make sense for us to start co-opting different avenues of attention that they're doing to get our agenda out? Wouldn't that be a very effective way to show black self-respect and be pro-black, because it's already attention in that particular area? Why not co-opt that and make your points or give out whatever your distress is, since all of the cameras and whatnot are right there? Or am I? I could be overstepping. I just wanted to throw that out there real quick.
I think that there's a lot of things that we could use that the enemy uses against us for ourselves. I just think that we've been so effectively brain trashed into being ideological tribalists who are just vehemently disagreeable, that it's really hard to do that. It really, really is. But I think it's a great idea, because there's a lot of things that I've talked about, and I specifically talk about European Jews, because my wife worked around them for many years. I've worked around them for many years, and they have certain codes. And the codes that they have is what helps to keep them cohesive as a group. And they have a code where they shop with their own. They have a code where they only go to Jewish doctors. They only eat at Jewish establishments. They only live in Jewish neighborhoods. Like, that's how they function. They do not do negative things or criminal activity to other Jewish people. That is their code. They do not break that code. And my wife and I have both seen that in play. My wife even more than me. So these are things that they do that we could take from them and do the same. I have a code. Anytime I contact black people, I'm pleasant. You know, I try to give them a smile. You know, usually when I'm riding the train, I always put my backpack in the seat next to me, because I don't like, I really just like to either be by myself or have a black person sit next to me. So I offer the seat to a black person that's passing down the aisle. And sometimes we'll just get into really great conversations riding the train. Other times they're doing their thing, I'm doing mine. You know, so it's all about, to me, just doing sometimes the little things. I remember one time I just helped a sister just carry her bags down the stairs to the train, because she had a bunch of bags, and I was like, "This some things look heavy, and that's ridiculous that she's going to be like having to go through all this." So I said, "I want to help you with your bags." I just told her so she didn't get startled, and I walked her down the stairs, and she was almost speechless. And I'm just like, "Yo, this is the way we should be," you know. I said this should not be surprising to you, but I said, sadly, that's where we're at. Hopefully we can get to a better place. And I said, you have a wonderful evening. And that's it. I went about my business. And, you know, these are things that I just try to do as regularly as possible, where I see that I can contribute sometimes in those little ways. You know, and that's just one example. So it's just about developing a code where you choose to be courteous, be respectful, helpful where you can. That's a part of trying to be just, is trying to be helpful. If another person, black person, needs help with something and you can help them with that, then, hey, try and help them.
I agree.
These are all things, and sometimes you can do that and have negative experiences. So don't expect things to be rosy all the time. It's just not the way we've been programmed in this country as victims for 500 years. It doesn't work that way. You know, be prepared that sometimes some people are just going to be ungrateful. They're going to be angry because we always suffer through something. So I always try to even keep that in mind. I don't know what that person's going through. So even though they might be nasty, it's not for me to, like, black out on them and just, you know, start screaming at them or be threatening towards them because they happen to be nasty. They could have had a horrible day. And you know, I just happen to be the person that they chose to take that out on. And that's happened to me before. When I was younger, it would have incited something else. But just being more aware of reality and being more aware of the fact that we suffer all the time, and some people just really get to places where they can't take it anymore. And as a result, they lash out, like the proverbial lion with the thorn in his paw.
Yo.
So that person might not, you know, go ahead.
I have come to understand that when you are that person that does these courteous things, you normally do attract that aggressiveness from somebody else because you are willing to listen. So you end up taking the blunt of most of their frustration because they have nowhere else to release it. And what tends on happening is that at least in my different scenarios that I've been in, I tend to run back into those people, and I get great stories about how that brief moment of kindness rubbed off into the rest of their day. Whether they gave it to their spouses, husband or wife, their children, or other family members or other friends, sometimes even strangers. So it pushes forward. That's what I'm trying to say. It continues to go forward.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to be the one that gives out that love. That way that love can reciprocate somewhere else. It don't always come back to you, even if you get cursed out or what have you for showing that love. So thank you for doing that, by the way.
Hey man, I just try to do the best I can. And it's just something I try to do as regularly as possible. And I try to speak about those things because sometimes, like you said, you never know who you could have a positive effect on.
Well, hold on, Brother Rise.
Those things. I just
we have a caller. Call out of New York. Welcome to Real Life, the radio show. What is your name? Where you calling from? What is your question or comment?
Peace. This is Kujo from NYC, from Brooklyn.
Greetings.
Peace.
Greetings. Yes, thank you for having me on, and greetings to the callers and listeners as well. You know, it's true. One of the basic things, definitely, I'm kind of piggybacking on Roz, and then I have a question or a statement, I should say. But it's definitely one of the most important things that we could do is to really be consistent with our behavior towards each other in a positive light, and it's very difficult. Depending on the circumstances and the areas of people interaction that you're dealing with to do that. But the consistency is the most important point, because the reality is we should be the most kindest, loving, caring, and nurturing towards each other every single time we see each other, no matter what. Mm-hmm. And again, it's difficult, but it's something that we have to do. Also, as far as a statement, earlier, in regards to like anger, I do feel that anger does somewhat of a role in our awakening to some degree, because I feel like that is a stage that should not be taken away, because part of the reason why we all, I mean, myself included, I heard what Roz was saying, I heard what the gentleman was saying, and I went through the same cycle too of anger as a youth. And it's a very dangerous thing, having that anger in the system of white supremacy and not knowing what to do with it.
I agree.
And
I
you have a lot of us out here trying to figure out what direction to go, but not really getting any of insight or information from family. My family was good enough in the early stages to actually do this and was very helpful. And my mother basically told me one thing repeatedly over and over again. She says, you have two strikes against you. You're black and you're a male. You have to be very careful how you walk, talk, and move in society. You are not their favorite. And that helped me, but it also was difficult for me as my family started to mature or started to get bigger, and we had white people come into the family, and these discussions started to smother away, so to speak. They started to go away because people didn't want to offend them, you know, which I I could care less. But that was a difficult process. But I feel like anger is still plays a role, but it can't be the overall end, basically, or so to speak, for everything. And
right.
as far as pro-black, I mean, I really think we need to really work on that. I have questions in regards to that too, because I do meet people that are in so-called interracial relationships that say they're pro-black, and I'm not sure what they do, but outside of them being with a person that's white, I'm not sure what else they may do. They may be involved in movements throughout the city and trying to help educate young non-white people to become stronger and more informed outside of their relationship, you know. But I still think, I mean, at the end of the day, and I've had this said to me over and over again by a lot of older black women, which is, you can't fight white at the end of the day, fight white and then sleep with somebody white at the end of the night. It just doesn't work too well when you really get down to business and you're really trying to solve this problem. It's a very difficult thing to do. But again, these are steps and things that I think we have to still hash out and discuss, and at the same time do exactly what you brothers were speaking about earlier, keep extending ourselves to each other and being kind and courteous and figuring out these things as they go along, you know. So I'll mute my line, but thank you for listening, and I appreciate your show and your time and energy.
Oh, peace. No worries. I have a response to that, but we have a brother Scotty. Your mic is open.
Yeah, thanks for allowing me to chime in again. Great call from the caller. But I would like to offer some other stuff to consider. So, again, I appreciate, you know, all of the people who came before me, our elders, because they've been around much longer than we have, and we can learn from their experiences if they wrote about them, if they spoke about them. You know, Needy Fuller broke it down into nine areas of people activity. As earlier I was talking about, if we, especially in the United States, because if I'm in Nigeria, it's not an issue of whether I'm black or pro-black or not, right? It's if I'm pro-Nigeria, if I'm in South Africa, if I'm pro-South Africa. So being codified, like Mr. Fuller said, in the area of politics, you just want to talk about justice. You don't want to trigger these white folks or suspected racists. Well, I wouldn't even say suspected racists. You don't want to trigger racists or give them any ammunition to accuse you of being anti-white. I mean, you know, in people activity area of sex, again, am I practicing justice? And I mean, I shouldn't be concerned about, and I'm speaking for myself and my codification, I shouldn't be concerned about who a person is so-called sleeping with. Because, again, if I'm practicing justice, I'm not judging people based off of skin color. That's something that Black people, particularly in this geographical location in certain parts of Africa, like South Africa, that lived under strict white supremacy, apartheid. So I know I'm getting a little long-winded here. So, but are we practicing justice? We know that they used to have laws against quote-unquote Black people marrying white people. To me, that's none of my concern if those people are practicing justice. What they, you know what I'm saying? That's just simply how I look at it. I got to look at it, am I practicing justice? Because it just throws a red flag up when I have Nazis or white supremacists agreeing with me in the people activity area of sex and saying, you know, so that makes me think, what are they afraid of? Why don't these white people, well, if you believe in the theory of Dr. Franz Kress-Welstein, they fear genetic annihilation. I hear some of us, you know, speak on like, we're going to be, it's impossible to genetically annihilate, quote unquote, Black people or African descended people or melanated people. We want to expand it to places like India and aboriginals all over the planet. So again, it's just a basic matter justice, because you never know. You know, that's like an abolitionist friend of mine, Max Parthas, who I worked alongside of for 6 years pushing abolition. It was illegal for his mother, for him to be born, because he had a white father and a Black mother. You know what I'm saying? So when we have allies like that, or people that's considered Black, because if you look at Black history, look at all the leaders of the not all the leaders of the rebellions, but when you look at like a Nat Turner, half white, Frederick Douglass, half white, we could go on and name those who still, you know, was down with practicing justice, which was expressed during that day as being anti-slavery. So again, you know, if we're going to practice justice behind these enemy lines, I think we got to have some codification about us.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Scott. Yeah.
Thank you too, Cujo.
I think that you were going to say something, Jenna?
Well, we down at the bottom of the hour. And it's time to say the prayer. Fine. We're going to have to go deeper into this Black and white relations next Tuesday. I guess it will be a part two. So,
yep, I thought so.
And, yes.
I thought so.
So, Cujo, hopefully we see you there, because we're going to dig a little bit deeper into that subject. And it's going to get interesting.
And we still want to complete it, too. There's still more to add to it, but that's going to be definitely delved into further next week for sure.
So with that being said, Brother Roz, if you will, take us out of here for the night.
All right. Thanks to everyone for being with us this Tuesday evening, November 6th. We greatly, greatly appreciate your time and your energy. Thank you for the support. Please continue to support Black Talk Radio Network, and please join BTR community as well. That's another way you can support the network, with the added benefit of joining a closed social space for Black people to have discussions about things that pertain to us. So thank you for that. Have a wonderful evening, and creator willing, we will see you next week, Tuesday. We're going to get into the prayers now and close out. Creator, we ask that you help us to remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us to remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time that we are in contact with another Black person. Like Gus says, it has been time to replace white supremacy with justice ASAP. Also, stop human trafficking. And let's end the prison industrial slavery complex. I am in the love of the all, and all love is in me. I am a part of the all, and the all is a part of me. I am one with the all, and the all is one with me. I can succeed as a part of the all and fail as an individual. I can be all that I wish in the all, as long as my wish is to stay in the all. I am never alone. The all is, I am. The all can, I can. The all does, I do. Thanks again for spending your Tuesday night with us. Stay safe and stay out of the hands of those slave catchers. It is election time, so stay safe. Peace and love.
Peace.